The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, after last Monday's exclamation, I should be careful about not giving a Dharma talk. So what I'll do is I'll say a few words. And then I'd like to have a lot of time today for questions and see if you have any questions. And I'm curious what's on your minds. And what I thought I would share to you is starts with an example. An example is that if you clench your fist really hard, you don't have to do it unless you want to, unless you like to grasp things. You can clench your fist really hard, and really hard for a long time, so it begins to hurt. At some point, you feel the dissatisfaction of that pain and that grasping, and so it occurs to you to do something different. It occurs to you that there could be then the desire, the wish to ungrasp, to let go. And a desire to ungrasp, that process of releasing, is a simple thing, relatively. But on either side of the process, there's kind of like a state you can focus on. You can focus either on getting away from the pain of the grasping. So we'll say you're in the process of grasping, you can feel the pain of that and you want to get away from that. Or you could have some kind of clear sense, or not some clear sense, have some idea or some memory that tells you how wonderful it is to have an unclenched hand. So some people will focus on, I gotta stop having all this pain. Other people will focus on, I want to have that wonderful open hand. Both people have to go through the same process of releasing their hand. When the hand is completely, when the fist disappears, the hand is open, one person might stay preoccupied or think about or relate to that mostly from the point of view of what they were freed from. Someone else might feel how wonderful it is to have the hand open, and how now with an open hand you can do a lot of things with your hand you couldn't do with your fist. Or you can feel the breeze going across your palm. The same process of release, or the desire for release, can be done, be motivated from two perspectives. Either from the perspective of what you're leaving behind, or the perspective of what you're going to gain, where you're going. So in a spiritual life, in a Buddhist practice life, some people are looking backwards, or looking at the challenges they have, the suffering they have. And other people are looking ahead and seeing what's possible, seeing the possibilities. Some people notice where they've left, some people notice where they've come. Which one is right? Which is right? Which is truer? The religion of let's get away from the pain, or the religion of let's go to the light? The religion of let's get away from the darkness, or the religion of let's go towards the light? Is one truer than the other? What about the religion of doing both? It doesn't have to be one or the other. So one of the things I find very interesting is how descriptions of the spiritual process can be or perspectives on the spiritual process can be looked at from so many different angles. And so people can have very radically different descriptions of what they're involved in the process of spiritual path. So radically different that you wonder if they're even on the same path. Someone spends a lot of time talking about what they're getting away from. Someone else talks a lot about where they're coming, where they're going, where they're, what they've attained. And they kind of miss each other. The people who want to get away from the darkness, from the pain, suffering, they say the people going to the light are too optimistic, too idealistic. The people who are going towards the light, they're going to the freedom, say, those people who are suffering all the time, they're too pessimistic. Which is true. They both are true. And it's actually, I'm just using two examples, but I suspect that there are a lot of different angles can be used. And I think it's helpful so we don't get stuck in some idea that this is the only way to describe a spiritual path or only thing to do. It happens that the Buddha tended to, in his teachings to people, tended to focus more on the suffering part and getting away from the suffering and the process that gets you away. And in his descriptions and discussion, he talked less about where you're going. He did sometimes, but his emphasis was in that direction. Later in Buddhism, there are whole other schools of Buddhism that put more emphasis on where you're going and less on where you're going from. One of the arguments why it's important to talk about where you're going from is that it's really important to have a clear understanding of your condition. And so it's not too idealistic where you're going, not just an ideal, but you really understand your condition so you can understand your condition really well so that you know how realistically to work with it. If you only focus at what the light and where you're going, that might be fine as long as you have light. But find yourself in a darkness and you're lost. But if you understand the darkness well, then you can kind of find your way out more easily. But the main thing I wanted to say here is both can coexist. And you find sometimes in the teaching of the Buddha, or kind of in Buddhism, a wonderful coexistence of both perspectives. And there's two emotions or attitudes that are very central to Theravadan Buddhism and to early Buddhism. And one of them is, I'll give you the Pali words first. The first word is samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A. And the second is pasada. And samvega they say it's kind of an emotion, it's a reaction of the heart, response of the heart, that feels the unsatisfactoriness of life as we usually live it, the pursuits that we're usually engaged in. So, for example, if there's a lot of pursuits that can seem pretty meaningless after a while, or not important, or even worse than that, what was I thinking? What was I doing? And some people spend a whole career engaged in an occupation, a livelihood, for example, that at some point they wake up and say, what was I doing? I've known people whose primary orientation towards work was money. And making as much money as they could. And I remember meeting one stockbroker, at a Buddhist monastery. And he was so happy being at the monastery. The fact that he'd lost his client's money maybe added to why he was running away. But he looked back at his life, the way he lived his life, chasing money and making deals and whatever he was doing, and felt that he had left a life that made him very a kind of feeling of a dissatisfaction. This word samvega also can be associated with a weariness, kind of this that kind of life is, I'm tired of that. It's tiring. It's exhausting. A feeling that maybe this is meaningless to be engaged in a certain kind of pursuits. life as it's usually lived has a certain kind of meaningless quality to it. Sometimes comes through in the samvega quality. Now, if only thing existed was the samvega, it would be kind of depressing. But the other side of samvega, and what's the emotion that's kind of supposed to go with it, is a beautiful word called pasada in Pali. And pasada seems that the primary meaning of pasada is clarity and serenity. Clarity and purity and tranquility, something like that. But it also has the meaning of faith. faith or inspiration. And so, on one hand, we see that a whole bunch of pursuits are meaningless. On the other hand, we see the possibility of a heart or a mind which attains a degree of purity, of light, clarity, of tranquility. And there's a kind of inspiration for that possibility, a faith in that as a possibility. And that's the kind of the good news. That's focusing on the light, whereas samvega focuses on the darkness. And what happens if we hold both of them together, hand in hand? And what I'd like to suggest, maybe I'll change my metaphors, it's kind of like the two legs that allow you to walk. And you can walk in a stable way if you have two legs. If you have only one leg, you're kind of unstable. And so there's two legs for walking the Buddhist path. There's the path that understands what the challenges and difficulties are, understands something about how the mind makes up meaning, assigns meaning to things in a way that perhaps is not accurate and reliable, and frees itself from that kind of way of being, feels discouraged or dissatisfied with that. So some kind of very profound dissatisfaction is involved in the samvega. And the other involves a kind of a profound satisfaction, profound understanding of maybe what really has meaning, what's really meaningful, what's really significant, what's worthwhile to do. And it has a lot to do with qualities of heart. It's a whole range of them. The qualities of heart that sometimes make it maybe subsumed under the qualities of heart that come with purity, with light, if you use that kind of metaphor, with a certain kind of peace. So to walk the path with both. And one of the reasons it's important to have both is that to remember both, or to cultivate both, understand both sides, is it's sometimes people get lopsided by focusing more on one than the other. Sometimes people have very deep insights in practice that really can see the unsatisfactory nature of many of the ways they've lived their lives, their self-identity, their self-image, how they relate to others socially, the pursuits they're doing. And it can be really a challenge, really discouraging, really a challenge to only dwell on that. And so to realize there's another side, and to be inspired by the other side, is a lot of the function of this thing called pasada. And so it's very interesting that one of the primary words for faith in this tradition is this kind of synonym for these words of tranquility, of light, of purity. Here in the West, when we use the word faith, many people associate that very quickly with creed, with belief. And perhaps there's good historical reasons for that. And in Buddhism, when you hear the word faith, the tendency is to associate that with qualities of heart, like that are qualities of mind, like peacefulness and serenity, light, purity. So when Buddhists use the word faith in the West, sometimes there's the problem of using words, and people have different reference points for it. And so if a Buddhist teacher says, you've got to have faith, everybody's going to run, flee. no way, I'm not going to believe anything I don't want to believe. So those are my words. I've talked long enough. So now it's your turn. So what would you like to ask or bring up or discuss? by telling you ahead of time that you're going to have time for questions, you'd be preparing and be ready. And yes.
When you talk about compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity, now, those are like dwelling places. Okay. And then you were talking last Sunday, you were talking about how the things that we know, the four foundations, and you were saying that we know our body, like the heaviness and the gravity and how the body feels. And then you said that we know that we are present, so that's the second foundation. The third foundation was we know what our state of mind is. And the fourth was that we know freedom. Now, I'm wondering, when we're talking about the dwelling places, the compassion and the sympathetic joy and so on, now, is that like the third thing?
Okay. The qualities of mind, states of mind.
And what are those things called, and what's the fourth one? There's compassion.
Oh, the four divine abodes?
The four divine abodes, yeah.
The fourth one, which in the Theravada tradition is the foundation or the source for the other three. It's loving kindness.
Okay. Thank you.
And the basic disposition of kindness, of loving kindness, of friendliness, when that disposition encounters someone who's suffering, it morphs into compassion. When it encounters someone who's having wonderful things happening in their life, it morphs into sympathetic joy. And then when it encounters someone who is suffering, but for whom you cannot do anything for, you can't help, and then it can morph into a certain kind of love, which we call equanimity. So those are those four would be considered states of heart or states of mind. So they would be the third of these four things that can be experienced directly. So a deeply contented audience. Well, here we go. Yes.
So I want to go. Yeah, I want to go back to the clenched fist that you were talking about. Is that where we're trying to control our thoughts and the things that are going on in our reality, and then we learn to let go of them? And then that's where we find the peace, or is there...
That could be one version.
That could mean different things to different people.
There's one version of grasping, yeah, or one description. We grasp onto our ideas, our thoughts, our concepts. We try to control our life, control it by preventing it from changing, controlling it by forcing it to change, many things, but yeah. And grasping has this idea of being this compulsion, where there's it hurts to grasp, and grasping has this quality that usually you can't let go of it easily, and so that's why we have a practice to help us learn how to let go, and there's many motivations to reason to let go. One is to avoid the pain, as I said. Another is to let go so that the things that we can receive the benefits that come when we let go. So you have a clenched fist, there's a lot you can't do with your hand. You can't be a, you couldn't be a surgeon. And there's a lot of people who need help. So, someone has to unclench to really be able to help. Many things. You can't caress the head of a child. You could, I guess, but it would, with a fist. But
well, I just want to mention about Christmas decorations. I've been looking at them at night, the inflatable ones, and I think, the true reality is when you're sleeping, everything is luminous, and then when I see the Christmas decorations on the lawn in the daytime. There's nothing there. It's all empty.
Beautiful. And the Buddha made this analogy, said that, life is like a bubble, like a dream, like a shooting star. If he lived in modern America, he would have added to that, it's like a Christmas ornament that blows up. All that promise. And
what are some of the tests for things that you know, situations with people that you know you can't do anything about?
What are some of the tests?
Tests. Think about or think, you know, go through a litany of what are some of the things.
The question is, how would you decide whether you can make a difference or not? Wow.
Things you can't do anything about. You just kind of said that.
Yeah. So how would you know that? How would you decide? How would you know that you can't do anything to help? Wow. What a good question. It's a great question. I never thought about it exactly that way. You know, what are the... How would you know? How do you really know? Well, you know because you tried and didn't help. You know, you tried and they wouldn't listen. That's one way. And sometimes you can feel how shut down they are, closed they are, and they're not. You can't even approach them. You can't even get close or bring up certain topics without them pushing you away. And sometimes you can make a difference for someone. You can help them, and it lasts for an hour or a day, and then they, you know, you manage to get them to stop drinking alcohol, but then the next day they're back. And you realize you can't just go be with them side by side all the time. And if you've tried enough, at some point you have to realize that, you know, you've done what you could, but they make choices for themselves. And and sometimes, I see it with my children. I don't know what the test is, but, you know, sometimes it seems that with my kids, that... they have to make their own poor choices so they can learn. And so sometimes there has to be the wisdom to know, okay, leave them alone. You know, I know better. I could change them and not that so my kids won't suffer here. But I don't think it's the job of parents to prevent their kids from suffering every possible suffering. I think the kids would not grow very well. So sometimes we have to know when it's good to leave people alone so they could struggle on their own. You know, Buddhist teachers are a strange lot. Because, you know, you could come to a Buddhist teacher and say you're struggling about something, and they get happy. Great. So I don't know, but that's a good question. So if someone else want to share some ideas about how would you know when you cannot help someone?
I have a slightly different take on the question, not an answer, unfortunately. And that's, if it's an individual, then it's difficult, but it's somewhat clearer that, okay, I can or I can't help. But where I'm finding a hard time staying equanimous is, you know, I read The Economist. And, you know, okay, there's the Middle East, and there's North Korea, and there's Iran, and... it's hard, or even just our own economy, or the state of California's economics, it's hard to say, you know, okay, I can't deal anything with that, I'm just going to go on with my little world, and, you know, help where I can, where I'm teaching, and that just seems so inadequate. It's hard to stay of balanced mind, knowing that the world's going to hell in a handbasket, you know.
I don't know if we're supposed to keep it's wise to keep a balanced mind letting things fall apart. I think if you really feel something is off, something is, they're suffering in a strong way, I would hope that you'd be motivated to do something about it. But you can't do something about all the difficulties in the world, because then you're spread too thin. You just kind of, it's crazy making. But what I do is I take the things that I see that concern me, that worry me, that motivate me, and I try to channel that motivation into doing a better job of the few things I've chosen to do. I try to stay informed. I try to take care of the bigger other things to some degree, but I allow these things to motivate me. So rather than making me feel helpless, I feel like in a sense, they inspire me. They give me more juice. This is important, this world we live in. It's important to respond and do something. And the small things you do, I don't know what small things you do, but small things can go a really long way. And probably it's all the small things that will add up to prevent the next war.
My answer would be to pay attention to what the energy that you feel around it. And I think if you feel like off balance or like you're being drained, then that's not something that you can actually be doing something about from a good place. If you're feeling positive energy about doing something where you're giving and helping a situation, then that feels good. That's an energy that feels right. Loving. That's how I would tell.
Great. Thank you.
I would look at the one's intention. One's intention as to, oh, you want to help? Oh, what's the intention behind
the intention?
The help. And your capability, your wisdom behind, is this possible? Is this within parameters that make sense?
Yeah, is it possible? Are you capable of doing it? I knew a woman whose best friend, when she was 14, her best friend committed suicide. And she'd spent the day with her friend, and she thought for a long time she had this idea that she could have done something to make a difference. And all the adults told her, no, you couldn't have done anything. And then she encountered a Buddhist teacher who said, oh yeah, you probably could have done something that would have made a difference, but you weren't old enough to know what that was. And that freed her.
For me, I think it's has to do a lot with the balance of how much I do and how much I listen. Probably with more emphasis on listening. And I think in a way the doing is a sort of a function of the listening.
So if there's only doing, watch out, it might be a problem. But if you've listened really well, then the doing maybe is well informed and maybe more productive. Thank you.
Just to add to the energy, you know, you can also, sometimes you don't have the energy to help someone, but you can delegate. Maybe you know someone that has knowledge and the energy. And so you just kind of show another path, help that person by showing something else, because you feel that you don't have enough knowledge to help them.
You point them in a direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, please, Mary. If you can.
I just wanted to relate a personal experience, and I guess it's a kind of a deep philosophical question behind it. I just spent 4 months up near the Oregon border in the wilderness area, and I had a lot of time to reflect. And I was thinking about some of my defects, and I decided one of my personality defects is I give out too much advice to people. And I began thinking, well, you know, how often has someone taken my advice? And I've given it in all kinds of different nice ways and very gentle ways and forceful ways. And I've been into holistic health for about 40 years, and oftentimes people have conditions that can be cleared up very easily just by some of my wonderful advice. And what I concluded was that it was probably less than 1%. And so I really wonder, you know, if everything, we're just all on a track and we're just going to go, it's sort of, things are sort of predetermined. And I don't think there's a person in this room that is here because someone came up to them and said, you know, I got some really good advice. Dump your religious tradition and come to IMC. So I just it's kind of put me in a space of letting go, and that's been helpful. And I thought I could do something to change the world, but I just think of myself now as just a peasant sloshing my way through the swamp and the of life, and things are just going to turn out the way they're going to turn out. And I was just wondering if you had any comments.
I'm happy for you. you know, one of the interesting things it raises is what can we do for someone else? What's most useful? So, you know, the old kind of cliche, is it better to feed someone or teach them how to grow their own food? You can feed them for the day, but if you teach them how to grow their food, then they can, you know, feed themselves for a lifetime. So is it better to teach someone how to overcome an illness, you know, with your kind of holistic health advice? Or is it better to teach people to the skills that allow them to get sick and old and die with peacefulness? Because your holistic health advice is always going to be of limited value. Because sooner or later, they get sick, old, and die. But how do you hold that? And so what's most useful? And that, you know, it's a, who knows, different times, different things, or maybe both advices can be done. But I was struck by, you know, you're learning to let go. And that letting go is a wonderful quality, ability, that is useful in so many different settings. And not only that, but how you are as a human being, in letting go and being open and relaxed that way, might convey something more profound to your friends than what you can convey by giving them advice of what to do. It might show them a whole different way to hold their life that you wouldn't convey to them if it was you're writing hard on top of them and saying, you know, you've got to do wheatgrass. So I'm happy for you, and I think that as you let go in this deep way, that you'll probably then find that you're a better friend for your friends, or more, you know, more useful, and more. You become the model, the example of what's possible.
Yeah.
Well, you inspired me already. Yes.
I was going to say, connecting with what this gentleman was saying, and also the ladies, who you are speaks louder than, you know, your advice. You know, so I think then everything boils back to just practice and working on our own liberation. And also, like, you know, just when I run into different people in different situations, I ran into somebody who was helping me with my computer, and this person had very severe, obvious physical problems, and it seemed to me he was really suffering. To be able to give that appearance physically, I could tell that there was something wrong, and I just felt it was not morally correct for me to leave that situation with him helping me without him knowing about mentioning this place, which he already knew about, and also, and he's not coming, and also I also told him about the specific technique that I use to release the blockages that are causing his illnesses. And I showed him how to do it and everything. And then one time, when he came back another time, he said, "I don't want to do it." Mm-hmm. He's had lost members in his family to horrible things. And he does. He specifically verbally told me, "I don't want to do it. I don't want." So I think where it ends is that if I see a need, and I have the tools, like you said, to help relieve suffering, I tell the person, and that's it. You can lead a horse to water, you can't make them drink. So as far as when to know to help, you know, you make the initial offering, and then you have to let it go.
Good. Sometimes you can offer a second time. But You know, it's also a matter of, you know, seeing what, you know, listening is a good thing, or paying careful attention. You know, some people need friendship or compassion or listening more than they need our help. Or that's the help they most need. And so, you know, so to listen well enough or be present well enough, just be present. Some people just need to have someone present for them. But then to be present well enough to see what is really needed here. And even someone who is in dire straits might have a greater need for human connection than they have for, you know, to get them out of those dire straits. And so, so you know, we have a lot to offer each other. I think we live in a world where there is a lot of suffering, and we live in a world of suffering as a community, as people sharing this planet together. And it's very, I think we're very lucky as a, that we can actually do a lot for each other. And we support each other, we benefit each other, we can offer our kindness, our compassion, our friendship. We can help at times. I think it's very important to do what we can. And I'm very inspired by how from a purity of heart, or from an emptiness of heart, from freedom of heart, from a non-grasping heart, how much can flow outwards in order to be of support and help to others. And certainly my hope that people who do Buddhist practice, that Buddhist practice transforms them, changes them into people who can offer help and support to this world of ours. So I hope that's the case, and I hope that during this holiday time that you remember that probably the best thing that you can give is not things, but pieces of your heart. So thank you so much.